Paul was up on the old metal driver's seat, and Anna was on his lap, her little hands on the steering wheel. She turned to Josie, grinning.
Look, Mom, she said.
The garage was full of mounted animal heads, which seemed odd to go through the trouble of killing and stuffing them all, only to hang them in this dark, unvisited place. Think of that. To kill animals and care so much for them, or be so interested in celebrating the kills that you would pay hundreds of dollars to mount them, only to warehouse them in this unseen room. It spoke of the endless bounty of the animal world, legions of replaceable mammals, more than enough to stuff and hide away some great percentage of them. Josie thought of her own basement, the things she kept there, even while knowing she would feel freer without them. She knew she felt liberated outside that house and felt freer without her job, freer away from those hot, dirty mouths. She felt freer here than at home, freer here alone than surrounded by her purported friends, and she felt sure she would be far freer without her bones weighing her down and her flesh draping over her bones, all this ugly aging skin needing food and water and moisturizer. To be a ghost, to see all, to see anything, but never to be seen. This might be bliss.
We should go, she said to them. Paul was outraged. You mean leave?
She had just been struck by a strange feeling. The heads on the wall had done it. The sinister nature of their deaths had gotten to her. She'd been lucky the night before, and that luck could, would, fade, or more likely, change abruptly.
No, Mom, Paul said.
He then laid out an entirely rational argument. That they had been there one night already, that no one had come, that they had left the note on the door, that he could leave more notes, on the windows, on the door to the chateau, to the cottage, that the worst that could happen would be that they would pay for two nights. The towering tragedy of a single parent is that your eldest child becomes not just confidant, but valued counsel. They decided to stay, with Josie reserving the right to change her mind at any time that day. The sky stayed blue all through the morning, and they had an extravagant lunch of hot dogs and rice and pastrami, using the cottage stove and microwave, and eating on real plates and with glasses made of glass, sitting on stools by the kitchen counter. And afterward, Paul and Anna returned to the lawn, where they set up and played their own version of croquet. They found a tiny frog, and Anna somehow caught it without fuss and carried it around in her little fat hands for an hour. And Josie watched from her chair and finished her trails grown dim. A good one. My great-grandfather, James A. Lehman, a Confederate veteran, Private Company D, Cavalry Company A, received an honorable discharge May 10, 1865, and entered Confederate Soldiers' Home at Higginsville, Missouri, October 19, 1900, from Pulaski County, Missouri. He was listed as a resident there as late as 1902. He left to enter the home at Pee-wee Valley, Kentucky, and was there January 31, 1905, in room 31 in the South Wing. Here my record stops. No death date or place, and no burial place. Will appreciate any help. The day was overtaken by dusk, Josie was exhausted, and there was very little food left. But she managed to make omelets and a bizarre salad containing lettuce and watermelon and bacon bits and pieces of sausage. The kids devoured it, and by 8, they were all ready for sleep.
Can we? Paul asked.
By all means, Josie said, and Anna climbed the ladder to the loft, and Paul followed. He reached down for yachts and yachting, which he planned to read to Anna, and Josie handed it up to him, looking around the cottage for anything left to do. There was nothing. The simplicity was complete. Maybe, she thought, they all needed one long rest, a 12-hour binge to feel right again. She turned out the main light,
leaving the cottage with only the porch light and the bedside lamp next to the kids, who she could hear under the covers, Paul reading in low murmurs to Anna. The door opened so quietly that Josie assumed it was one of her children, but her children were in the bunk above her. Then it must be the wind, she thought. She hadn't closed it tightly enough, and the wind had pushed it open.
What's happening here? A man's voice said.
Josie jumped at the first word. She turned to find a young man in camouflage pants, a sleeveless shirt, and baseball hat. His eyes were small, blue, his goatee black. In the single second that lingered between them, Josie had time to hope that he was a gentleman, a proprietor who found the note and understood, had found Paul's child handwriting endearing. There was the possibility in that second that this man only wanted to know what was happening and that Josie could easily explain it, that he'd accept their money and welcome them to stay.
Who the fuck are you? He said instead.
Josie didn't breathe. His small blue eyes, his hunter's outfit, anything could happen.
We left a note, she managed to say.
Is that your RV? Are you a squatter? Who are you with?
He asked. He hadn't seen the children yet. He stood in the open doorway, Josie standing 5 feet away, his feet ready to move, as if unsure he wanted to be with her in the closed room, as if he'd encountered a bat in the cottage and wanted to allow passage for it to fly away. Josie looked up to see where Paul and Anna were and saw nothing. They were hiding in the loft. She couldn't imagine how they knew to hide. How Paul was keeping Anna quiet, but she had a split-second moment of admiration for them. She thought of Anne Frank.
You just let yourself in?
He asked. Josie had already decided she wouldn't mention the night before. She would tell him they'd just arrived, had written the note, had money, would settle all this.
We saw the sign, she said, hearing her voice so thin and scared. No one answered the door. There was nowhere else to stay.
So you broke in?
Now his volume spiked. Something had turned. He could be on drugs. His hands were fists. Josie looked for a weapon, then looked up to the loft again. No sign of the kids.
Who's up there?
He asked, still yelling.
Who the fuck is up there?
Please, take it easy. We'll leave.
No, we'll call the police. That's what we're doing. You stay here.
And he left. She didn't know where he'd gone. Maybe he didn't have a cell phone, or had left it in the main house. But he'd left them alone, so she had a few minutes. She rushed up the ladder and found Paul and Anna under the covers and awake. Their heads were pressed together, Paul's arms around her in some kind of death embrace, a Pompeii pact.
Let's go, now, she said.
Josie grabbed Anna and flew down the ladder in 2 steps. She reached up and took Paul from the first step, pushing them both out the front door. She returned, found their duffel bag, stuffed it with the clothes she'd removed, and met the kids on the porch. She paused, looking and listening for the man. There was no sign of him. They needed to get to the chateau, but couldn't use the path.
Follow me, she said.
She picked up Anna and led Paul by the hand through the woods, toward the bluff, intending to follow the cliffside to the driveway. The man wouldn't see them until they'd gotten inside the RV.
Mom, careful, Paul said, pointing to the sheer drop only a few feet to their left.
Shh, she said, moving swiftly toward the driveway. Now she saw a man emerge from the main house. He had a phone on his ear, the cordless receiver of a landline, and was looking in the direction of the cottage. She assumed he was calling the police. Fine, she thought. Now all she had to do was get to the chateau and go. The police might chase her, but they couldn't be anywhere near here. She'd have a 20-minute head start. Her heart was in her mouth, her ears. She watched the man, standing outside, facing the cottage. He was looking for movement from her, assuming she was still inside. All she needed was for him to return to the main house or go to the cottage to find them. That would give her time to get to the RV and leave. She turned to Paul.
We're running to the chateau, any second. Ready?
Paul nodded. The man took the phone from his ear, pressed a button, and the orange lights of the receiver went dark. He tucked the receiver into his pocket and strode to the cottage, his white form crosshatched by the thicket.
"Now?"
Paul asked. "Wait," Josie said. When he was just before the cottage, she hissed, "Now!" And they sprinted out of the woods and across the lawn and toward the chateau. They were at the gravel driveway when their footsteps gave them away.
"Hey, get the fuck back here!" the man yelled.
Josie opened the cab door and threw Anna inside. Anna hit something with a thump. Josie knew she would cry, but that she was unhurt. Paul stepped in, and Josie shoved him over. Before she got in, she saw the man hurtling toward her across the lawn and down the driveway. He was astonishingly fast. She closed the door, threw the key in the ignition, and started the engine. She threw it into gear, and the chateau lurched forward just as a loud bang hit the rear bumper. She'd hit him. No, he was banging his hand on the back of the chateau, now the side. The back of the chateau dipped. He'd grabbed the ladder. He was riding on the back. Impossible. No, possible. He was the kind of man who would jump on.
"Go! Go, Mom!" Paul said.
"I'm going!" she hissed. She slammed the pedal down. The engine groaned and the gravel spit. They lurched forward and turned heavily to the right as the driveway wound toward the highway. "There's a man on this car," Josie thought. She imagined him hanging on the back, crawling forward to her. By the time he reached her, he would be ready for murder. Ahead, the driveway rose suddenly to meet the highway, and she sped up, thinking the sudden incline might toss him from the ladder. The front bumper slammed into the pavement, and the hood leaped up with a crunch. The chateau bounced and squealed as she turned and sped onto the highway. "Get in the back," she told her children. Anna was bawling, but Josie hadn't heard her until now. What if the man was on the back and got in, through the roof, some other way?
"No, stay here," she told Paul.
"Stay here, both of you. Hide down there," she said, and pointed to the floor of the passenger seat. She wanted them near her, within view. Paul obeyed and huddled with Anna in the dark. They were on the highway now and reached 20, 30, 40. She could only assume the man was still on the ladder, but there was a chance he'd jumped off, had fallen off. But she couldn't stop to be sure. If he was still hanging on, the man was now crazed and desperate and would harm her. But she couldn't just drive on, speeding on the highway with a man hanging from the ladder, could she? She had to. So she did, while waiting for the sound of the man climbing or pounding or the dip of the back end as the man jumped off. In a flash of inspiration, she realized she could stop at a gas station, and there, under the lights, she could stop and be safe. He wouldn't try anything. So she drove north another 15 miles until she saw the blue-white lights of a gas station looming. She slowed, listening closely for any movement, the sounds of a man crawling on the tin box she was driving. When she pulled in, she saw a figure inside the green glass, a woman standing at the counter, watching a tiny television. Josie looked to see if the woman saw anything strange on the chateau. The woman glanced her way, then returned her attention to the screen. Josie stopped the chateau as close to the door to the station as she could and waited. He might choose this moment to attack, to avenge his harrowing ride. But again, there was no movement. An idea occurred to her. She honked the horn. The volume was tripled under the canopy and echoed against the glass of the food mart. The woman at the counter startled and looked to Josie, eyes wild. Josie waved, said she was sorry through three layers of glass, and frantically beckoned the woman out. The woman shook her head no, she couldn't leave her post. What reason could anyone want her to leave? The only possibilities were all dangerous. But eventually, Josie cajoled her into leaving the counter. The woman opened the front door of the food mart and poked her head through.
"I can't come outside," she said.
Josie rolled down the passenger side window.
"You see anything on the outside of this RV?"
she asked.
What's that again?
Is there anyone on the RV? A man hanging there?
A man on your RV?
The woman had been scanning the chateau all along, but her eyes had not alighted on anything.
No.
So there's no one up there? On the back either?
Now the woman's eyes looked scared, confused about Josie and the task she had been assigned. Still, she craned her neck around to look over the back of the vehicle and shook her head.
No.
Only then did Josie feel comfortable opening the door. In another ludicrous calculation, she tried to think of the man's possible point of attack just outside the door, so she decided to leap from the doorframe into the open blue light area of the gas station, creating as much distance as possible between herself and the chateau. Maybe he would jump, miss, and land on the pavement? She opened the door, leaped, and nothing happened. She lunged back to the door to close it. For hadn't she just left her cowering children in danger? And then quickly paced around the station, looking from every vantage point for a man in camouflage pants who might have been clinging for the last hour. She saw no one. The woman inside, though, was on the phone, most likely reporting Josie to the authorities. Josie thought briefly about staying because she hadn't done anything that the food mart lady could claim or any police officer could prove. She got back into the chateau and drove off, picturing a bottle breaking against her face. This hadn't happened recently, but this vision, a bottle breaking against her face, had been an intermittent part of her life since she was 12. She could not explain this phenomenon to anyone without provoking grave concern, so she never mentioned it, because it was not problematic or a symptom of some flowering psychosis. It was not related to the numb face. It had predated the numb face by 20 years. She had been in sixth grade, just after Candyland, when it started, and it occurred regularly since then, and it was not a big deal. It was just a recurring vision of a bottle breaking against her face. Of the tens of thousands of thoughts she, like anyone else, had in a given day, a couple times a day there was the vivid picture of a bottle, a 70s-era soda bottle with its curves and striations, breaking against her face, and it was not a big deal. Exactly who was holding the bottle was never clear, and their motives were not known, but in any case, the bottle would swing into her vision and shatter against her nose and cheek, the shards spreading like rain. It was never painful. It was not troubling. It was just a bottle breaking against her face. It had something to do with punishment, but it was also a little slapstick, too. It was a bit of pie in the face, a bit of corporal punishment at the hands of an angry clown god. It was nothing, really. Her children were still hiding on the floor.
You can get up now, she said. She's asleep, Paul said.
They were so entangled that Paul couldn't move either without waking Anna, so Josie left them there on the dark, dirty floor and kept driving.
Chapter 14. Josie awoke to a shrieking. She was sleeping on the kitchenette couch, her children sleeping above, and they were in an RV park she'd found somewhere around midnight. She had no idea where in the state they were. Through the kitchenette blinds, the day seemed balmy and clear. 6 hours earlier, she'd been driving through the night, had found the sign, the gravel road, and she'd paid $45 to park with full power. She'd gone to the office and woken up the manager, a handsome man in his 50s or 60s named Jim, and he'd been kind and understanding and had given her keys to the shower and a code for the clean-out. She didn't tell him she wouldn't be using it. He'd given her a shot of bourbon, too, guessing she needed it, and afterward she'd walked numbly to the chateau and fallen asleep on the couch. Now it was morning, and Josie was awake, and someone was still shrieking. It was somehow obvious that it was happy shrieking, though. Cheerful shrieks of, "Hello! And here we are!"
"Mom?" Paul called.
"Down here," she said. Paul climbed down from above
and while she lay on the couch, he spread himself on top of her like a cheetah on a heavy bough. Anna followed, climbing down from the loft and then on top of Paul, stacking herself carefully. Josie absorbed all their weight and briefly thought it was wonderful, then knew it would soon kill her. "Off," Josie said. They stretched and ate cereal, and when the sun rose past the tree line, they left the chateau, and Josie remembered where they were. In her mind, she replayed the drive there, the gray light of her headlights scraping across the parking lot gravel, then into the office, meeting Jim, the bourbon, him showing her the layout of the park and the most secluded spot. There was the main house, the office, a large and solidly built structure of red logs and white putty, a wide porch. There was the gravel parking lot facing the river, and then a loose grid of RVs and mobile homes tucked against the woods. The two-lane interstate was nearby, above, but quiet, and passed over the river on a simple stone bridge. When she stepped out to feel the day, she noticed she was parked next to another vehicle, this one seeming more or less permanent. There was a white picket fence around it, and in its windows there were flower planters and flags. Josie thought about what day it was and realized it was Saturday. There would be a wedding that day at this RV park involving the shrieking women. If they shrieked at 8 a.m. while bringing plastic forks into an events hall, what noises would they make when the ceremony was underway? The events building was between the chateau and the river, and so it seemed natural enough for Josie to set up her folding chair facing the wedding party. She went inside, made herself tea, and returned to watch the proceedings as she would the morning news on television. The door behind her opened with a whine, and Josie turned to find Paul and Anna dressed in yesterday's clothes. "Who's getting married?" Paul asked. They were very young. The men were dressed in their groomsmen suits, their jackets off, while the bridesmaids wore shorts and tank tops and would change later, and together they began decorating the building with streamers and white carnations, while uncles and fathers brought tables and chairs inside. A great time was had by all, with the bridesmaids occasionally lifted off the ground by the groomsmen who threatened to throw them in the river, provoking more shrieking. They were so young, and Paul was walking slowly toward them as if drawn by some unseen force. Josie said nothing, wanting to see how far her son would go. 3 steps, and he stopped, watched. 4 more steps. Anna was uninterested, was playing in the chateau's shadow, talking urgently to herself while holding a muscular green man, but Paul was in a trance, his hands in front of him, his fingers, twisting fingers. "There's someone in my class I could marry someday," Paul said, without any emotion, as if noting a passing cloud. "Helena?" Josie asked. "Yeah," he said, his eyes fixed on the guests still arriving. And now, from under the bridge, riding on a path along the river, came a group of 6. First, there was a man of about 50, wearing a black vest and black pants and a button-down of sky blue. He was riding a mountain bike and seemed to have won a race because he said, "Ha!" as he passed under the bridge and entered the gravel parking lot. Behind him was a woman in her 30s in a pilgrim's dress, a conservative cotton garment, gray and trimmed in white, its hem tickling her ankles. She was wearing a bonnet and was grinning, her face red and alive, so happy that she'd come in second. So they were Mennonites, Josie thought, or Amish. But they drove here, that was certain, so that would rule out the Amish, so Mennonites. She'd once seen a Mennonite family praying before a meal at Burger King, and that Burger King had been in the middle of nowhere. Thus, that was allowed. Driving to the Burger King, eating at the Burger King, driving to RV parks in Alaska with a trailer of bicycles. She settled on them being Mennonites and sat in the grass, with one eye on her children and the other on this Mennonite tableau still developing. More bicyclists followed. 3 children, boys of 8 and 12, a girl of 10, and then, most intriguingly, another woman who seemed to be about 20, too old to be the daughter of the first woman. They all got off their bikes,
laughing and whooping and wiping their brows. They'd just had the greatest time. The boys were in black pants and all wore the same sort of blue work shirt as their father. The girl and woman wore something similar to the second place woman. They parked their bikes, each carefully positioning their kickstands in the gravel.
"Whoo, boy," said the father.
A smile overtook Josie's face. She spun around to see if she was the only one witnessing this. She looked to her children, who were now stomping in the shallow water, oblivious. Josie turned back to the Mennonites. The man was husband to one of the two women, but who? The kids were by the older woman, she was sure, so the younger woman was along for fun, a niece, a fellow member of their church or village. Her parents had died? She'd been orphaned, taken into this other happy family? Josie contemplated who she would have been had she been born or married into this family. What would she want? Would her desires have been simplified? All she would want, perhaps, was this: a good, vigorous bicycle ride along the river, coming in second, just behind the handsome husband. How marvelous it all was. Whoo, boy.
"Look,"
Anna said, and pointed downriver where it bent. A tribe of kids were playing in the shallow water amid a tiny forest of high reeds. Before Josie could stop her, Anna had run down the bank. Paul followed, warning her to be careful. There were about 12 kids, from 4 to 10 years old, and their interest seemed to center on a huge downed tree which lay dead in the shallows, its branches rising tragically, diagonally to the sky. Half of the kids straddled or hung from its branches and periodically dropped into the ankle-deep water below. It was only after watching the group for a few minutes that Josie realized she was the only parent present. Josie looked down the riverside, not believing this could be true, and finally found what appeared to be the parent charged with looking after the 12 children. She was a woman of about 60, a grandmother perhaps, standing in the shallow water, talking on the phone, smoking, gesticulating, laughing a hoarse, happy laugh. She looked up to find Josie, and she managed to both wink and wave simultaneously. Her smile was very warm, her wink seeming to acknowledge the beauty of the river, of the day, the gorgeous madness of all the kids playing together, of the two of them allowed to simply stand in or sit near the river, doing nothing. Josie waved back. Feeling the other woman could handle it for a minute or two, Josie retrieved her folding chair and brought it to the flat, grassy riverside and sat and watched. Now there were 15 children, then 20. The children of the river were trying to move the large tree. The alpha boy, shirtless and wearing pajama pants, had taken control of the platoon and was insisting that the tree be moved, and he was directing the other children to grab here and there and there, and you over there at the end. At one point, he even said, "Lift with your legs!" His voice was husky and impatient. Josie's own children happily submitted to his directives. He was the foreman of all the work being done, and he knew how to lead. Josie puzzled for an explanation of why the log had to be moved, but the children under his command labored unquestioning. Now he seemed burdened. He stood, watching his workers, hands on his hips, dissatisfied. Something was wrong. He lowered his head, came to some conclusion, and raised it. "From now on," he said, "we'll have to use fart power." He said it in a tone of seriousness, of resignation. They had apparently run out of electricity, fossil fuels, and now they would use what was left. Josie had long wondered how pioneers, how bands of cavemen, knew where to stop and settle. Along this trip so far, Josie had seen a few places where she thought, there's a lake, and there's a mountain, and there's a rolling meadow where she could watch her children play. But there had been easy reasons why none of those places seemed suitable places to stay. Most were near highways. But this park, sitting at the bend of a river, spoke of welcome and permanence. Then again, Josie thought, looking at the road where it crossed the river,
There was at least some possibility that the quiet of the morning could be broken by sirens looking for her. She had a quick vision of this woman with her by the water and the invisible parents of the river children rising up to protect her. She hadn't spoken a word to them, but believed that they had formed some kind of community, watching the children moving logs under the power of young flatulence.
Hypnotic, right?
It was a man's voice. Josie jumped. She turned to find Jim, the man who had checked her in last night. Now he was standing behind her, holding a blue cup out to her. It seemed to be pink lemonade. He had a cup of his own. No thanks, she said, but he made no effort to remove the cup from her view, so she took it. He clinked his plastic cup against hers.
I checked you in last night. Is that your name or your way of life?
He said, and nodded toward her visor. I found this, she said, and saw that he was disappointed. He thought he'd delivered a zinger. But, she wanted to say, nothing good can ever come from noticing anyone else's clothes. She sipped the lemonade, discovering that he'd spiked it with what tasted like rum. She decided that because it was noon and because she had escaped an innkeeping madman the night before, she deserved this. Thank you, she said, trying to see him. The sun haloed his head, putting his face in purple silhouette. She remembered him as handsome.
You on vacation? On the run?
He asked. Will you sit down? She asked. I can't talk to you standing above me like that. He had no chair, so sat on the grass next to her. You don't have to sit on the ground, she said.
I want to,
he said, and ran his fingers through the weedy grass like it was plush carpeting.
He said. Your stay good so far?
The best, she said, with a useless sarcasm she did not endorse. He explained that the establishment was his, that he'd bought it 5 years ago after moving up from Arizona. Josie assumed he knew she was single and wanted to convey that he was not a clerk at the inn, but its owner. Jim was younger than she'd remembered from the night before, about 55. Sturdily built, strong shoulders, a round belly. There was a tattoo on his bicep, only partially visible, something military. She could see the claws of an eagle. He was a vet, the right age, build.
There's a swimming hole around the bend of the river, he said, pointing downstream where the river made a hard right into the woods. Just an eddy about 3 feet deep, but it's got a rope swing. You like to swim? Are you like one of those chefs who won't leave the customers alone? She asked, meaning it lightly, but her voice sounded barbed. Guess I am, he said, and stood. See you around campus.
As he walked away, the bottle broke against Josie's face, but it was not a big deal. It was just a bottle across the face. All day, Josie allowed her children to wander near the wedding party, eating outside within sight of the preparations, and then playing in the river with the other kids, all of them with one eye on the men and women in black and white, rushing back and forth between trucks and vans and the building. Go see what state they're from, Josie said to Paul. Paul smiled and ran. Alaska, he said when he returned. Are they really getting married today? He asked, and when Josie said it seemed so, he asked where the groom and bride were, and Josie was not quite sure. All the men were dressed the same, but there was one young man who seemed slightly less joyful than the rest, moving slower, weighted with the trouble of his responsibilities, and she assumed this was the groom. Let's take a bet on who the groom is, she said to Paul, and he asked if he could get a piece of paper to catalog the possibilities. He flew up to the chateau and returned with the Yahtzee pad, which he turned over and began writing down differentiating details for each of the men. Tall, skinny, red hair, he wrote. Shorter, brown hair, beard, he wrote. Glasses and limping, he wrote. At about 2, a new car arrived and parked behind Jim's office, close to the chateau. The bride, Josie assumed. She watched as 3 women rushed from the car into the office, an older woman holding the white dress over her head.
Soon, a stream of new cars appeared in a cloud of dust. A bald and portly man emerged from one of them, wearing a tuxedo, the first man yet to seem comfortable in it. "The father of the bride," Josie said, and sent Paul to listen in on any conversations nearby to confirm her suspicions. He returned 10 minutes later with no hard facts. "Must be happening soon," Josie noted aloud, thinking at least one of her children could hear her, but neither was within earshot. Young people in sport coats and blue suits and black suits, one white suit, all the women in very short dresses and very high heels, emerged from their vehicles and stepped through the gravel to the staging house. For an hour, there was no movement, no sound. They were getting married, and Josie couldn't hear a thing. At dinner time, she retrieved a few plates from the shower, and they ate inside the chateau, a frozen pizza and graying vegetables, and as the sky bled orange, the kids heard the laughter of other kids.
"Can we go see?" Anna asked.
Josie saw no reason why not, outside of her wanting them to stay with her inside, watching a movie while their heads rested on her chest. She wanted them near her and wanted to drink white wine while half watching an animated movie. She was ready to let this day peacefully burn to embers, but they wanted to extend it.
"Sure," she said.
She could not keep her children from whatever happiness was outside. Paul helped Anna get her shoes on, and while she watched Paul tie her laces, she looked up at Josie and said,
"I have diseases."
Paul finished one shoe and began the second. Anna was casual about it, as if getting her nails done, talking to a friend in the next chair.
"Do you know how to spell diseases?"
she asked, then answered her own question.
D-Z-Z-Z. Diseases.
"I don't think so," Josie said.
Anna took Josie's face in her hands and said,
"Josie, I have diseases."
Paul finished with her shoes, stood, and the two of them opened the door, Josie following them. Paul and Anna looked around, not immediately seeing the other children, but finally seeing the tribe not far off. The kids had made an impromptu seesaw using a wide plank sitting atop a balance beam. The alpha boy was standing in the center of it all, his arms crossed in triumph. Josie sat in the doorway of the chateau, watching as Paul walked toward the tribe, Anna following. Suddenly, Anna turned back to Josie.
"You forget something?" Josie said.
"Yes," Anna said, and took Josie's face in her hands.
Josie laughed and kissed Anna on the nose.
"No,"
Anna said, and repositioned her hands to get a better grip on Josie's face. This time, Anna came in for a more romantic kiss. It was all there. The closed eyes, the puckered lips, and Josie let her daughter go for it. She kept her eyes open, wanting to see what Anna would do, but after a moment of lips to lips, Anna seemed satisfied and withdrew with great solemnity. Then she wiped her mouth with the back of her arm, said,
"See ya."
Night came on, and Paul and Anna returned, sweaty and complaining about falling off the teeter-totter. They were settling in for the night when a thumping reshaped the air. Josie assumed it was from a car passing over the road, but the pounding only grew louder.
"The wedding," Paul said.
Josie went outside to see if this really could be music and not some kind of military assault. She walked to the meeting house, where the lights were bright inside, and saw the silhouettes of 100 people crammed tight and moving in sudden diagonals. Paul and Anna followed her, unbidden. "The reception," Josie said, and explained the idea to them that the ceremony and dinner had happened quietly, and now there was this, so loud, and it would go late. She thought about leaving the park. She thought about what she could stuff in her ears to muffle the sound, but there would be the thumping in the ground, in the air. They would not sleep.
"We should stay here,"
Paul said, and stood, squinting at the meeting house as if they'd bought tickets to some outdoor concert and had found just the right spot. Josie sat down and brought Anna into her lap.
From their vantage point, they could see the festivities through the large window, the guests passing across its bright picture screen like actors in a party scene. The bride had bright blonde hair and arms covered in tattoos. The groom was very tall and bearded and seemed to be crying, laughing, lifting one guest after another off the ground and spinning them around. The music bled one song into the next, and the heads kept bobbing, and Josie pushed her chin into the furry mass of Anna's hair as Anna drew ovals on Josie's arm. It was not novel for Josie to be apart and stare. As a teen, during the worst years of Candyland, she'd been through a very long few years of aloneness. A brutal and wonderful and terrible time of luxuriating in her tortured mind, her suddenly heavy thighs, her growing nose, the rumors about her parents, the word Rosemont on everyone's tongues, always implicating her parents, her feeling of being horrified at being alone on weekend nights, but not wanting to be among people either. She railed against the injustice of her always being alone, but she loved being alone. As some sort of compromise, she'd taken to long walks at night, and that led her into the woods behind homes all over town, and when she walked behind these homes, keeping herself deep in the trees, often there were bright lights, and the people inside were illuminated as well as aquarium fish. So on these long walks, she would often sit and watch the families sit or cook or undress, and she found it reassuring and necessary. At a time when she doubted her place, doubted she was doing anything right, doubted her skin was really hers, doubted that she walked correctly or dressed correctly, and at a time when she covered her mouth any time it was open, watching the quiet tedium of everyone else's lives gave her renewed confidence. Her family was considered strange and unholy, a twisted family, awash in VA drugs, but these other families were no better. All were deeply boring and sedentary. They barely moved. She would sit in the patchy woods watching a house for an hour and scarcely see anyone move from room to room. She watched classmates, and they were dull. She watched a classmate's mother walk around in a bra, watched another classmate, a burly athlete, shockingly kind to all at school, come home and immediately get thrown across the room by his father. She saw certain things, scenes of violence, loud and simmering. Being deep in the surrounding woods, she was never close enough to hear a word, and so, in those dark woods, in the blue light of these sad homes, she realized she was no less normal than any of these sorry souls. "I'm tired," Josie said. And by that she meant she was tired of being apart from the world. They had been alone and on the road for many days, and those days had seemed like weeks. Weeks where she had only her children to talk to, and there was nowhere they knew to be home. And now they were watching again, or Josie was watching again, people who belonged in the world, who were rooted and reveling in their place, who were dancing triumphantly inside. It was never good to think about Carl, his then disdain for weddings. She didn't want to be with Carl. What if they'd been married? Good God. But a wedding would have been nice. She'd never had everyone in one place, the people she loved. Could you have a wedding like this at 40, 41? A raucous thing like this, the women barefoot in their tight dresses, dancing naughtily? You could. She could. Or perhaps she had made too many mistakes. Two children from one eel-like man, a fractured past, no family. Was she a drifter? Josie had a heavy, warm child in her lap, Anna's red hair smelling like lemons, and she had another child standing next to her, above her, leaning against her, and he was a noble human and always would be. And yet her life was that of a drifter. Where are you from? Here and there. Where are your parents? Doesn't matter. Why aren't your kids in school? We're doing an independent study. Where are you going? And then a door opened in the meeting house, a bright white sliver that enlarged into a yellow rectangle. Light poured out from the building and down the lawn all the way to Josie and Paul and Anna, caught in the light. A man was in the door and seemed to be relieving himself. It couldn't be. There had to be bathrooms in the building, but no. He stood, one hand on the wall of the building, the other holding his fly open, a man pissing dramatically, and even from their distance, Josie could hear the spatter of urine against the clabbered wall. When he was finished, he turned, as if to take in the night air and bask in good work well done. But he seemed to freeze, as if he'd seen Josie and her children and was appalled by them. And now he was walking toward her. Shame came over her at once. She knew he would scold her for sitting there and watching their sacred event. It had been a vulgar thing to do, to just sit there like it was all some show for their amusement. She would tell him she was nearsighted and couldn't possibly see that far, that she was blind and was just listening to the music. Now the father of the groom was upon her. "You and your beautiful children have to join us," he said. He was standing over her, his face round and kindly and bright with drink and sweat, his hand outstretched as if asking her to dance. "No, no," she said, and suddenly she couldn't breathe. "Oh, no," he said. "I didn't mean to make you cry." Josie apologized. "No, no, it's very nice of you." Why was she crying? Her face was soaked and she was choking. "No, I didn't mean to," she managed to say, but couldn't complete the thought. But he understood. He understood that she'd spent the day wondering why she hadn't had happiness like this. Jesus Christ, why had she made all the wrong decisions? These stupid teenagers getting married knew how to have a beautiful and humble wedding by this Alaskan river, goddammit. Why did she make it all so difficult when it could be so simple? And now the father of the groom was taking her hand and leading her to the lights of the party. She choked desperately on her tears, but the father only held her hand tighter. She turned around and took Paul's hand, and he took Anna's hand, and like a string of construction paper people, they walked to the white tables and the lights and music, and when they arrived, Josie was still crying and expected to be deposited at some far table and given cake. But the father pulled her and her children deep into the dance floor, and they were suddenly in the wild heart of it all, with the groom and bride making their fluid thrashing movements, everyone jumping, and no one questioning for a second why Josie was there. And now Anna was on the groom's shoulders. But how? And now a bridesmaid had lifted Paul to her level and was dancing with him, cheek to cheek. Everyone was turning, turning, and somehow Josie managed to dance too, finding the rhythm and drying her face and smiling as much as she could to tell everyone she was okay and knew how to dance too. The band played until 2, and when the band left, the guests retrieved instruments from car trunks and drunken music was made until 4. Josie couldn't recall when she'd gone to bed. The kids were asleep on their feet at midnight, and she carried Anna to bed at 1, the red-haired groomsman carrying Paul. And for some time, Josie lay trying to sleep in the chateau, so close to the campfire laughter. And finally, she returned to the party, was welcomed to the fire, and one by one, the guests passed out, as the best man, knowing his duty, kept the fire fed. Chapter 15. When she woke again and ventured outside, the park was bright and empty. The guest cars parked near the overpass were gone. The vans and trucks were gone. The flowers were gone. The tent was gone. It was just before noon. The right thing would be to leave. Josie knew this. The park was desolate without the wedding guests, and Josie had already stayed too long. More than a few days in any place was unwise. She knew they should go. But instead of leaving, she went to the office and told Jim she was staying another night and asked if he'd like to eat lunch with them.
"I just had lunch," he said.
"Dinner," she said.
How about I make you some salmon?
He said.
My brother sent me a bunch from Nome, and I need to eat it. It won't keep much longer in the fridge.
The kids played in the river with a new group of kids who had arrived that afternoon, and at 6, they walked to Jim's cabin 100 yards or so through a birch forest and found him at the grill, wearing ironed jeans and a peach-colored polo shirt.
Made you a mojito, he said, and handed her a glass of cut crystal.
She took a sip. It was cold and far too strong.
Got a head start,
he said, indicating his own empty glass, and poured himself a second. Josie stared at him, imagining what he would have looked like as a young man. He looked like he'd gotten everything he wanted.
Grenada,
he said. Okay, Josie said. Nothing surprised her anymore. Certainly not a man suddenly saying Grenada while holding a spatula.
I saw you inspecting the ink, he said, and pointed to his arm, the military tattoo.
He raised his sleeve to reveal the words obscured before. Operation Urgent Fury. Josie had never heard this moniker. These words, urgent and fury, applied to Grenada, seemed a wonderful joke.
It's just a joke now,
he said, and Josie relaxed. She was relieved, first of all, that he was not a Vietnam vet and that they wouldn't have to talk about that, or about her parents, or Candyland, and she was so grateful that though he'd been part of the invasion of a country the size of the Mall of America, and though he felt, or had felt, some pride in this, the tattoo, he didn't take it too seriously. In an instant, Josie pictured a show. Grenada. No, it would be called Grenada? A dozen soldiers would parachute onto the stage and ask themselves where they were. Grenada, one would say. Another would ask, Grenada? This would go on throughout the show. People would die, helicopters would crash, medical students would ostensibly be rescued, a petty dictator would be overthrown, and all the while, the U.S. soldiers would keep forgetting where they were. One would knock down the door of a local home, pointing his gun at a family of 5. Where are we? He would demand. Grenada, they would say, their hands in the air, a baby wailing. Grenada? The soldier would say, mugging for the audience. You could call it a comedy.
Don't judge, Jim said. Grenada made Kuwait possible.
Now Josie was confused. What in the hell was he talking about?
You don't remember the national mood in the 70s and early 80s, do you?
He asked. Josie was a child during much of that time and had not been paying attention to the national mood, no. She needed to change the subject. If they went down this road, soon enough they would arrive at her mother and father, Candyland, Jeremy. Jeremy had already stepped into her consciousness and darkened the gauzy happiness of the day.
You have a wonderful awkwardness, Jim said,
and for a moment Josie thought the evening was being ground to dust, first by his nonsense about Kuwait, and now this, an oblique insult.
You're beautiful, but you wear it so lightly. This,
and here he touched the small of her back with an open hand, heavy and warm.
This is where the self-satisfied women, the uppity ones, lose their appeal.
Somehow he had known to change the subject and had effortlessly chosen a very chaste and very erotic place to put his hand. He was so confident. Her sense of time shifted, broke down. Hadn't they just started talking? Now his hand was firmly on her back. They were ready to dance.
The other women, they're stiff here, he continued, his voice lower now, a rumble. They carry all their tension and outrage and impatience right here. It's a catastrophe. But you, the way you bend, the way you shift hip to hip, it's fluid. It's just a breeze through long grass.
Shit, Josie thought. Shit, shit. To be described is to be seduced. Shit, one turn of phrase, one thing noticed that she'd never noticed. It worked always. Hilariously, though, Carl had no idea. The one original thing, the one time he'd noticed something about her that she could remember, would not forget, he'd said while watching TV one night, a crime show. The detectives had shown up at the coroner's office, and he'd pulled open a cold steel drawer to reveal the corpse of a young woman.
"That looks just like you,"
Carl had said, leaning forward on the couch, and Josie had thought, will this harmless man kill me?
"He seems harmless," his mother, Louisa, once said to Josie, "but he has a terrible resolve."
What did that mean? Josie thought of that often. He has a terrible resolve. That and the comparison to the corpse, it made their last year together somewhat less carefree. Now, though, there was this man with his Grenada tattoo, his POW MIA flag, and he was so gentle. She knew a mistake with this man was inevitable. The only hope was to contain the damage somehow, release the lust, complete the seduction without too much mess. After dinner, Jim brought a set of markers and a stack of printer paper from his cabin, and Josie assumed he planned to suggest the kids occupy themselves this way while he made a move on her. But instead, he sat down and asked Anna what her favorite animal was. Josie knew Anna's answer changed, depending on the day and what show she'd last seen, so was curious to hear the answer.
"Windy the Pooh," Anna said,
and Jim repeated the word as Anna had said it.
"Windy the Pooh,"
imitating her, but somehow in a respectful way that seemed to confirm to Anna that her pronunciation was correct. He cracked his knuckles theatrically and began to draw. Quickly, the kids realized he knew what he was doing. He could draw, and they floated closer to him, one on either side, rapt. Anna soon had her hand on his arm, again demonstrating her belief in the transference of magic. It was a heartwarming scene, until Josie came around to see the progress of Jim's drawing and found an anatomically correct elephant standing upright like a human and holding a beer, a flaccid penis pointing to the earth between its legs.
"You guys run to the vending machines for a second," Josie said, giving them a dollar each. Only the second time in their lives they had held a dollar of their own.
The kids ran through the birch woods, and Jim sighed and sat back in his chair.
"Elephants have penises," he said in his defense. "Paul has one. Have you seen a whale's?"
"Your elephant even has pubic hair, you jackass," Josie said.
"It was flaccid."
Jim grinned at her, thinking she was kidding. She took the picture and crumpled it.
"No more penises," she said.
The children returned from the store. Jim drew for them again, everyone having a blast. For half an hour, he drew whatever they asked, and they colored his pictures. But why did Anna grunt while coloring? And then laid them out on the grass around his house, holding them down with stones. The evening had arrived at a place of perfect serenity, and Josie and her children and this stranger named Jim were a perfectly functioning little family. Jim couldn't have been happier. He was not the least bit bored. Anna put a blank piece of paper before him.
"Can you do a giant, but a nice giant?" she asked.
Jim threw himself into that one, moving his mouth as he drew. Josie watched him, and a truth revealed itself to her. Older men are not confused. They aren't going in seven directions. A retired man knows what he doesn't want, and to those of us who have been ground into dust once or twice or more and have somehow found a way to carry on, knowing what you don't want was far more important than knowing what you did want. Maybe a retired man is the real prize. An older man like this, or Sam's Leonard Cohen, no longer worried about money. His ambitions had been satisfied or ignored, and he could now afford to draw pictures for children for hours at a time, had nowhere else to be, could take his time.
"Who wants to play air hockey?"
he asked. Josie didn't want to play air hockey, or watch anyone play air hockey, but her children had jumped and danced at the idea, so off they went. They walked back through the birch forest and to the office. Jim plugged in the air hockey table and turned to Josie.
"Why don't you go somewhere?" he said. "They're fine here."
"Go where?"
"Didn't you ask about the bikes the other day?" Take a bike. Anyone you see in the shed.
Josie dismissed the idea because she had expected this air hockey idea to be a ruse to get her alone in the back office. She'd glimpsed a couch there and pictured herself sloppily on it. But Jim was soon playing with her children and barely giving her a thought. So Josie found herself considering the bike ride, then wanting it, then calculated the probability that riding the bike in her drunken state would end in her crashing and drowning in the river. But then she thought of the Mennonites and their bicycle joy and wondered what lay on the other side of the underpass that had made them so happy.
You kids keep going, and I'll come.